All right, welcome to class today. Before we begin, I felt like I probably should give some kind of explanation about the failure of our computer systems, because, you know, this is a computer science class, and even though those systems aren't the kind of systems we're studying in this class, it still feels like we might as well explain a little bit about what's going on, and then we'll sort of talk about what that means and talk about some state machines. So, the CS department has a variety of servers, and they all have disks, which traditionally we draw as fat cylinders. What a disk really is effectively just a big array, a big fixed length index, a list of bytes. In particular, it stores billions, or in the cases of the disk, we have trillions of bytes, multiple terabytes of data. But when you just have an array, it makes it a little awkward to deal with things, because for any given file, you would need to know the starting and ending index of the file, and what if somebody else tried to access that file as well, and so forth. So in addition to having the actual data that we might put in our file, maybe I have a file that just says hello, for example, that data needs to be stored on the disk. But in addition to that data being stored on the disk, there's some kind of information that tells me where I can find that data and what that data is. So I'm going to have some kind of information that's going to have the name of the file and also the directory it is in, whatever that directory happens to be. And it's going to have some information about permissions, right? It might say, for example, that only I can read, or the like, so that other users can't get there, so that I can safely store data in a system that multiple people are using. And the US department has at least tens, if not hundreds of terabytes of data, many, many disks, several hundred more, probably more than 1,000 distinct users that are all using the system. All of which is fine. This information about about the data, so this is the data, and this is data about the data, so we call that metadata, because data about data. And there's lots of metadata formats that can exist. So one of the oldest and best known is the file allocation table, or FAT, which is basically a big array of information. There are also various tree-like structures and so forth that exist. And what happened on Thursday, amongst the many disks that was found, there was a disk that appeared to be unused by one of our current system staff employees. Unbeknownst to that individual, there was an obscure server that individual didn't know about that was using that disk and was using a metadata format called iSCSI. Not that that's hugely important, but this was the format they were using to write to the disk. So there's data on the disk, and there was metadata written in this particular format. And said employee took this disk and had another computer that said, oh, we could use some more disks, and we're using these disks in the ZFS format. If they had picked the same format, this computer would have recognized that disk had meaningful data on it. Because one of them was storing it in one data structure and the other in the other, they didn't understand that there is data, and so they both started writing to the disk in different formats, overwriting different parts of the array with different information. As a consequence, this metadata got all messed up. So one of them would write that there's a file somewhere, and then the other one would overwrite portions of that with different information. And so when this one came back to read it, it would find data that it thought meant one thing that actually was supposed to mean something else, a different format. And because all of these things are connected, that ended up causing it to go out to other disks and do bad things because it misunderstood connections to other disks stored. And pretty soon we had lost basically all of our data. We have backups, so we started running the backups. The backups began at 1 o'clock on Thursday afternoon and completed at 8 p.m. on Saturday evening, because we have a lot of data to restore from backup. But in the process, it turned out there was some information that didn't get copied from the backup quite right. And amongst the things that didn't get copied quite right, there is this thing called a DNS table. There is a thing that tells the internet writ large where to find specific computers by name. And so some of that got corrupted and created from a copy that wasn't quite right. And anyway, The end result of all of this is that the department website, which was stored on one of these disks, or our class website, has been restored, but is periodically not working because some of the other data hasn't quite been fixed. And I've been in conversation with the system staff about ways of fixing that. It also means that we also had Kaitos, the system we use for quizzes. And it was a completely self-sustained system, didn't deal with any of the rest of these in any way. That's in part so that if you happen to get access to this larger system, you can't go look up other people's grades and so forth. But it was self-contained, and as far as we know, is still running just fine. However, this DNS system that would tell us where to find it lost track of it. And so when you try to go there, you don't find it. And so anyway, the system staff are working on this along with dozens of other problems that came because of all of this happened. The end result being that the quizzing tool last time I checked still wasn't up. Who knows? Maybe it went up in the 10 minutes since I last checked. Maybe it will come up while we're lecturing. But in any case, it did not come up in time for me to make you plan on taking the quiz. And if I don't give the quiz today, then I can't grade it tomorrow, which means I can't give you back scores before you need to take the next quiz, hence the email I sent out earlier this morning saying we won't have a quiz 11. It just won't happen. None of this is really this course's material, but it felt like might as well explain what was going on because maybe you're curious. Before I dive into actual course material, any thoughts, comments, questions about any piece of this? We will get into what this means to your grades here in a moment. Do we have class Friday? Did we have class Friday? Yes, we did have class Friday. And although the web server is down, I posted the recordings of that class on Piazza because Piazza is a different system and is still working as far as I know. There'll be an online quiz 11. Nope, the plans just remove on the quiz 11 completely. I suppose there, if people really want me to, I could add the online quiz back on and have it auto-graded on Friday. But I'm not immediately seeing benefit in doing that unless somebody wants to say, yes, I want it. Are we required to take something to replace your grade? Yes, we will talk about how the replacing works here in just a moment. I'll get to that. The short answer is no. Okay. So let's talk then about your grades. First off, I am sorry you can't see them. I do have a backup that I can access of everything you ever did. So I do know what your grades are, but I don't currently have a server to show those to you on. They haven't been lost. Even if the systems don't come back up, I can find some other way of sharing that. So first know that. I hope you remember where you were. We aren't having any further quizzes besides makeup quizzes. So that sort of puts you in a state where for each of logic and proofs and numbers and structures, you should have either mastery or competence or insufficient in each of these. Okay. Just as a random aside, since we've talked about this, if I have four things that can each have one of three values, that means I have 3 to the 4th possible situations. I will get to the question that was just asked about safeguarding things in a moment. So, all right, so we are, you are in one of 81 possible situations at the present time. And if the systems don't come up in the next day or two, I will find a way of sharing that with you in another way. I do have the data, I just need to find a way of sharing that. So, where do you go from here? We have two things left, quiz 12 and the final. I could rename quiz 12 quiz 11 because there's no quiz 11. I don't know. We could also call it the makeup quiz, however we want to do it. This will be next Monday. And that will be, I think it's Thursday, maybe Friday. I don't remember which one our final is scheduled for, but whichever one it's scheduled for will be when that is. This will be 45 minutes, and you can pick 0 topics to do it on, i.e. do nothing, or you can pick 1 topic to do it in. I'm limiting it to do one topic because I want to be able to grade all of these and get that feedback back to you before we get to the final. Given the potential number of people taking things and the amount of grading and wanting to make sure we don't have inconsistency, I'm not currently expecting to get that done until maybe midday Wednesday, but I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. I'm not trying to delay. I just want to make sure I can do it for everybody and get you all the same amount of prep for your final. So this will be one topic. It will try to be a sampling of all of the subject from that topic. And you can see what these looked like last, well, you could see. You will again be able to see what these looked like last semester. I'm expecting we'll get everything back up and running today. If we don't, I will find other ways of sharing things, perhaps with Colab or something, so you can still have the information. But the idea is we're just going to try to sample enough things to know, do you know how to translate logic to English and back again and perform basic logic? Do you know how to write proof by induction and contradiction? Do you understand about primality and factors and probability? Do you understand sets and sequences and functions and their properties? And so they're just designed to try to be a survey of that material. And this will be graded only as mastery, competence, and sufficient. You will receive only a single piece of information. Did I write Friday for the final special accommodations? I just don't remember when our final is. I don't remember whether our final is Thursday or Friday. Is it Thursday? I'm guessing by that question it was Thursday. Okay, so you'll get back this information. It will simply replace a bucket. It's not going to be point scored. I'm not going to try to figure out partial credit. I'm just going to look through and say, do you show enough that I think you'll do well in the next class, enough I think you can struggle by in the next class, or little enough that I think you'd not be able to do well in the next class that uses that information. You'll get a single letter, and that will replace that topic. And then the final will be 3 hours, and you can take 0 to 4 topics. And they will replace everything, including quiz 12 if you took it. All right, so we have several questions here. Will the final quiz have a format similar to the online quiz or the in-class quizzes? So they will be, the plan right now is to have them structurally like an in-class quiz. They may have some online quiz type of information. So I might ask those sort of multiple choice questions as well as written questions, but the current plan is to have you do it on paper and upload an image. I might adjust that because I haven't really thought carefully about what this will look like, but I will have to before Monday because it will be, these two will have essentially the same format. I will also comment that whether you decide to take any or not, you can look at all of the topics on both days and before you decide if you want to submit them or not. So here's a question about replaced or best. The statement is replaced. If at the end of the semester you don't appear to be competent in something, then I don't believe you're competent in a thing. However, if this means you go down, I'm going to look back over your previous work and see if I can figure out what's going on. And if I am confused by what happened, I'll reach out to you and see if we can come to an appropriate resolution. So I'm not guaranteeing improvement, but I'm expecting improvement or staying the same to be the dominant thing. Last semester, I had nobody go down. I had plenty of people stay where they were, plenty of people go up, nobody go down. But if somebody looks like they're going down as a consequence of this, we will visit and see what that means. Does that mean you can completely ignore the remaining assessments? Yes, 0 is okay for both of them. You don't need to take them if you don't want to. Do you need to select which topic you take before Monday? Nope. On Monday, I will release a quiz that will have all 4 topics posted on it. You will come look at that, decide if you want to take any of them. If you do, you will submit up to 1. If you submit 2, then I will, I'm not sure what I will do. You shouldn't submit 2. If you do, I think my systems currently will cause one of them arbitrarily to overwrite the other. I will try to make that slightly more clever. But currently, I think that's how it's designed. Are the grade cutoffs the same as what they were? Yes, but the grade cutoffs only appear to date. not in the future, because these are not graded on a point-based system. All right. Are the topics, we can take these topics. Yes, they are. Those are the four topics. If we take the same topic for both the makeup and final, if we don't do well in the boat, yep, you absolutely can. So yeah, absolutely. You can take quiz 12 knowing that if it doesn't go well, you'll get another chance in a few days to try again. Okay, I think I have answered the questions here. If I have missed your question, please post it again so that I can see that. Will they provide practice such as last year's finals? So they were last year's finals were actually already on the website. When the website comes back up, whenever that happens, or if it doesn't look like it's coming up, I will post on Colab someplace and let you know where. I have all of the previous assessments, including both the makeup and final. I should note, last year's assessments had 6 topics instead of 4 and had 30 minutes per instead of 45. So it won't be a perfect match, but we'll give you the idea of how things are looking. What do I mean by the previous? So quizzes 1 through 10, we had point to bucket, to mastery, competence, incompetence. And there was this aggregating of points. Quiz 12 and the final goes direct to the mastery, competence, incompetence. That is to say, I look at what you did and immediately give you that answer. I don't give you a number of points. Was there ever a quiz to replace the online quiz 7 that was due the first morning we returned from spring break? I don't think so. Why would there have been a sub quiz to replace that? I don't remember any issues with that quiz. If you had some personal issues with that quiz, please let me know. But I'm unaware of any issues for it. All right. Anything else that I should be answering? Okay, so somebody else is confirming that quiz 7 did work. And you ended up having, I think, 3 weeks to work on it instead of 3 days as usual. But if at any point, if you look at what's going on, you say, my situation is special, you're welcome to let me know that. I should comment that with 200 of you, my ability to answer every special case in a timely fashion, if a lot of you think you're special, may be limited. But my goal is that if something along the way has not gone well, then you'll have a chance to make that up next Monday with quiz 12 and show me that you do know the material. And if your question is something along the version of, I didn't take such and such a quiz, then my answer is almost certainly going to be, then make it up. Rather than trying to go back and make another equivalent numerically graded thing I can add in that is a significant amount of work, and for all of the possible states would be the grading would be an issue and so forth. So if that's your complaint, probably the answer will simply be take quiz 12. Sorry. Okay. So let's talk about our topic for the day. Let's suppose I write a function. I'm going to write a function called d. You know what? Let's first make a function with no arguments. And I'm going to describe this in sort of a code system. I'm going to say that I've got two variables, a, b, and I'm going to replace them so that a becomes b and b becomes a plus b mod 3. I realize many programming languages don't have this syntax. This actually could, with a little bit of extras of colons and defs and so forth, work in Python. But the idea here is that in a single step, I update two variables with these two things. So a becomes b, b becomes a plus b mod 3, all in one step. And then I'm going to return a. Hey, this is going to be my function. Now, this is not a function in a mathematical sense. Remember, one of the characteristics of a function in a mathematical sense is that any given input produces only one output. Any one argument produces only one result. This function has no arguments. And so if it is going to be a mathematical function, it should always produce the same result. And it will always produce the same result if A and B both start at zero. Or both start at any multiple of three, I suppose. But if in any other circumstance, that won't be the case. So let's consider the situation where I start with A is zero and B is one. Let's start there and just see what this function does. Okay. Now, to explore the behavior of a function like this that has some variables that change from run to run, what we'll commonly do is we'll draw a circle with the states of the variables inside, the values of the variables. And we will call this circle a state. This is the information about the situation, the state of the function. Okay? There's different ways we could represent it, but this is a fairly common one of a circle with the values of the variables inside. And when I invoke the function, I'm going to move from this state to another state. One invocation of the function in the state 0, 1 will move to the state where that 1, b, will become a, and the other one will become the sum of the two, which is 1, mod 3, which is still 1. And if I keep working on this, I can say, well, if you invoke it again, what will be the new state? Well, my first variable will become what used to be my second, and my second will become the sum of the two, mod 3. And if I invoke it again, I'm going to say, well, my first variable is going to become the second, and my second variable is going to become the sum of the two, which is 3, mod 3, which is 0. Okay? And I can keep going and try to enumerate all of the possible states I could reach. Because I'm modding 3, I have two variables, each of which can have the value 0, 1, or 2, so I shouldn't expect to have more than 9 possible things. Right, 3 times 3 is all I should be able to get. And so let's just finish this out. Let's see if we can enumerate them all. So from 0, 2, from 2, 0, I'm going to get the 0 first, and the sum of those two is 2, mod 3 is just 2. Then I'm going to have the 2 first, the sum of those two is 2. Then I'm going to have the 2 first, the sum of those two is 4, which mod 3 is 1. And then I'm going to have the 1 first, and the sum of those two, mod 3, is, so that's 3 mod 3 is 0. And then I'm going to have, give myself a little bit more space. And then I'm going to have the first of those, and the sum of those two, mod 3, is 1, and so forth. When we draw out this transition between one state to the next, we typically try to avoid duplicating things. The initial state here and the state I just drew are identical. Everything about them is the same. All of the meaningful state of the function is identical. They both have a 0 in A and a 1 in B. And so instead of drawing it as a new state, I would draw that as a transition back to the initial state. If I enumerate all of the states that can exist and how I get between them, we call this a state machine. Not that it's actually a physical machine, although you can design a machine that has this behavior, but this expresses how this thing moves. Each invocation of D is going to cause us to move from one state to another. This is the concept of a state machine. It gives us an ability to describe the kinds of things we have in code functions that we don't have in mathematical functions. This idea of internal state. Okay. We could also, if we wanted to, annotate each of these edges with what the action was we did to do things. We invoked the D function. And what it returns. And so we could annotate each of these edges by showing what it does. And in this case, it always returns the second thing in the state it goes. So the first thing in the state it goes to, or the second thing in the state it starts with, because it returns after the assignment, right? And so this is always just going to be the number that's on both sides, right? for this particular state machine. And so I could do that for every single situation, showing how this thing behaves. Okay. And so this gives me actually all of the behavior of this function, of this subroutine. Subroutine being a more general term for a function that could have internal state, the kind of things we write in code. Okay. I know all of the states it could be in. I know what it returns in all of those states. I know how to move from state to state. I have everything I need to understand this piece of code. Okay. So state machines will allow us to analyze this more complicated kind of code. Now, state machines can get more complicated than this. Let's adjust our function. Let's give it an argument. And let's use the argument as our modulus. Okay? So, if I adjust my function in this way, let me briefly ignore the returns. We may come back to the returning, but let's just consider just the states that we travel through. Now for this original state, what I need to know is that if you give me a 3, because I wrote the state machine for the modulo of 3. If you give me a 3, this is how we transition. But what if you gave me a different number? Let's consider what would happen if I gave the number 2. Well, if I give the number 2, I'm going to do the same work, but I'm going to modulo 2. So if my end result, my second number, was less than 2, then I'm going to have the exact same behavior. So 2 and 3 are both going to do that. But this one led to 1, 2. And 1, 2 modulo 2 is 1, 0, which we have over here. So if you give me a 2 from this state, I'm going to go over to that state, not to this state, because I can't get a 2. 2 mod 2 is 0. Okay, so if I get to this state, 1, 0, and I give it a 2, then I'll go to 0, 1. So the 2 will work for that state as well. And we'll see that now, instead of looping through 8 states, I'm looping through just 3 states. 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, if you give me 2s. And I don't have to stop at 2. What if, for example, I was given 4? Let's just sort of peek and see what this would look like. Well, as long as I'm not getting more than 4, I'm going to keep doing the same things. But when you would have, well, I would have gotten a 3, I'm actually going to get the 3. So from this state, I'm going to go 2 will be copied over, and then the sum of those mod 4 is 3. So I'm going to have this different state that I go to if you give me a 4, compared to if you give me a 3. And from this state, I'm then going to go to a state, if you give me another 4, of having a 3 first, and then the sum of those is 5, mod 4 is 1. And then from that state, the sum of those is 4, so I'm going to end up at 1, 0. So this is then going to go over to that state with a 4. And then this transition remains here as well. So I end up with a few extra states I could reach, but actually a shorter cycle. Instead of the 8 states I get for 3, or the 3 states I get for 2, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 states I could get for 4. Okay. And so as we're thinking about our state machines, we can try to analyze sort of in all possible inputs you could give me what will happen. We could even try to reason about what would happen for states that aren't on the main flow. So I have said, okay, if you start at 0, 1, what's all of the places you could reach? But we didn't have to start at 0, 1. We could also consider what happens if we start at the state 0, 0. And for all of these, it will just transition back to itself. Give it a 2, give it a 3, give it a 4, give it anything you want. even a one, it will always transition back to itself in all cases. Because you add zero to zero, you get zero mod anything you want. I could also think about things like, if you were in the state 3-1, and I gave you a number other than 4, if I gave you the number 3, then where would I go next? And if you gave me the number 3, then I would go to this state. Because I would take the sum of those two, which is 4 mod 3, to get a 1. And so we could try to do all of these possible situations and try to fill out every state we could imagine existing and where this would work. So we have this question, can you only do mod with natural numbers? Mod is usually defined for positive integers. However, it is relatively straightforward to define a version of mod that work for any positive real number. Mod is typically not defined for negative numbers, although the percent sign operator in computer languages generally do have a definition, and sometimes a different definition in different languages because they want them to work for negatives as well. But we could, for example, we don't generally, but we could say that 4 mod 1.5 is 1. Okay, and so programming languages that will have a percent sign modulo operator will often define that, but we could also do it this way. And why do I say that? Because if you divide 4 by 1.5, you get 2 remainder 1. Okay, but then if we say 5 mod 1.5, then we're going to get the remainder of 0.5. Right? So you can make this real number extension where you do the same thing. How many integer times can the smaller number go into the bigger number, and what is the remainder when you do the remainder as a result of mod? But usually we define mod only for positive integers. Okay. I could keep going and try to draw all of the other edges for every possible state for this state machine. I don't really feel like it'd be worth a whole lot more to add yet more edges and more transitions here. Besides just sort of pointing out from each of these states, we would just need to consider all possible inputs and make sure we know where that edge went, right? So for every state, we won't have an outgoing edge with every number we have considered as a legal input. And once we have that, we would be good. So for example, state 1-1 has a 2 and a 3 and a 4 all leaving it. We have analyzed it fully for these three inputs. But state 1-2 only has a 3 leaving it. And so we would need to do what does the 2 do and what does the 4 do from that state as well, in order to finish analyzing how this program works. Oh, we have a 4 out as well. We have 3 and a 4. So I don't have a 2. So I would need a 2 edge out of there to finish that out. And this one doesn't have a 4 or a 2, so it would need a 4 and a 2 added, and so forth. How do we decide what input to start with? I just picked one. It turns out that for the mod 3 case, there are 9 possible states. 8 of them are in this loop, so I could have picked any of those 8 and found this loop, and the last one is in this special loop. But for like 4, for example, there are many more states available. I could have had 16 possible states, and I only found a 6-element loop. So I've still got another 10 states that aren't allocated with this so far. And so I would, if I wanted to completely enumerate everything this function could ever do, I would need to pick those others. Any other questions about this example before we talk a little bit about how this is used and how we prove things with it? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the notion of computer security. Security is a complicated idea, but one version of security, one piece of security, can be thought of saying that there are some unreachable states. Okay. And we could also say that there could be some states cannot be reached except via some particular action. Let me see if I can explain a little bit about what I mean about this. Let's consider a computer. Let's consider a tower-shaped computer because they're easy to draw. A computer is a giant state machine. The state of a computer consists of all bits in RAM and all bits on the disk. And there's also these things called registers, all bits in registers inside the processor. And if you know all of these things, you know the full state of the computer. Now, this is a gargantuan number, okay? We think about, even if you had no disk, you probably still have gigabytes of RAM, where a byte is 8 bits. So you're talking about tens of millions of bits, which means 2 to the tens of millions possible states. It is impossible in any practical circumstance to ever imagine enumerating all of the states. We just can't do it. They're a gargantuan number. But we have a set of actions that can happen. And those actions are, there is a clock inside your computer and it ticks. It ticks usually millions of times a second, billions of times a second even, ticking away at gigahertz, billions of times a second. Every clock tick is going to cause the state to move to a new state. And we have the mouse can move, and we have the keyboard can move, and we have the network can send us traffic, and so forth. All of these are events. So when we think about our computer, everything the computer can do could theoretically be modeled as an unbelievably large state machine, where the number of actions is very large and the amount of state is unmanageably large, but we could theoretically model it in this way. And if we think about our computer in this fashion, then we can try to define the states that are not okay. For example, we could try to define the state where the disk does not have a valid data structure on it, and try to design a system where that state of disk is unreachable. What do I mean by unreachable? Okay, we mean, given a start state, so if you tell me how this shows up when you turn it on, you power it on, where do we start? Okay, so given a start state, I want to show that there does not exist a sequence of actions that achieves that particular state. Okay, so if we come back to this much simpler state machine than our full computer, if we say that when you power on the computer, we start in the state 0, 1, and you keep applying only these modulos, or if I only apply 4, for example, then I can't reach the state 2, 0, because the 4 only goes in this way. In fact, if you keep applying any modulo greater than 1, you'll never get to 0, 0 if you start in any non-0, 0 state. Proving that's a little bit tricky, but it's not too bad, and we might actually do that on Wednesday, we will see. So what we want to do is design the transition function, design the behavior of our state machine such that we can prove that something can't be reached. But the state is way too big. And so trying to actually prove this is going to be such a gargantuan proof, we're going to have a really hard time to do it, because we have to show that you can't get there. Okay? Or that you can't get there except via particular behavior. But we're still going to try. And part of the way we're going to try, because this is how we're going to have to prove things about computers when we want to prove the behavior of a computer, we're often going to design a much simpler state machine. Let me show you a little bit about what I mean. Let's go to... look at the Wikipedia article about a particular thing called the Transmission Control Protocol, a fundamental internet standard. In this article, assuming nobody has removed it since I last looked at it, they haven't, we find this picture. Okay. This picture I don't really think is super important for us to understand in detail. I just want to point out that this is a picture of how a particular part of talking between computers on the internet should work. And this is a state machine. In each box, we have a description of the state. One of them is marked as the state you should start in. And then we have arrows to other states describing the action that should move you from one state to the next. There's also a little bit of extra information about which ones are unusual events and which ones are done by client and server, so extra information. This is not code. This is a specification that you'll provide the developer to try to implement. We say this is how it should behave. And by having this simple state machine abstraction, we can then try to argue that some situations can't be reached. And so what that would mean is we're going to have to say, okay, for every one of these states, for all other possible signals you could get, what should we do instead? So we would, to do the full proof that the protocol, the conceptual state machine works, we would make sure we could show that no matter what happens, we will always end up in some state we understand and that those states are fine. Then we'll have a proven specification. And then we'll take it to the programmer and say, make your code do exactly what my state machine shows it and nothing else. And then it's on the programmer to pick appropriate variables and data structures and functions and all the things we use in code to implement this state machine. Almost always involving storing more state than we've discussed to handle other kinds of things. But as we're going along, we can design this system to deal with all of the different kinds of situations that we might want. So when something is potentially has multiple avenues of communication, and when it crashing could really break things, we will very often see a state machine used to communicate it to the programmer and also to try to prove what it can do. And so we'll try to prove that for the state machine we design, the state is unreachable. And then the process of testing your code is just verifying that it always does what the state machine says. Thus sort of breaking up the task into two separate tasks, a proof about a simple state machine, and then verifying that your code implements that state machine. Okay. Let's just talk a little bit about how we would go about proving something on a state machine. Let's go back to this basic state machine here. Okay, our function D. Let's even go back to our function D where it only has the number 3. Okay, so we're gonna take our D of 3. If you always give it 3, I might want to have the theorem. Okay, I might want to say that D of 3 will never reach state 0, 0. How can I prove this? How can I show that I can never reach this state? Well, the basic proof techniques we already know are going to be useful in working out this problem. Okay, so we have induction, we have contradiction, we have cases, we have direct proof. These techniques will be used in all kinds of scenarios. And often when we're going this, we'll start by trying to draw a picture. And one thing I could do is say I finished drawing the picture. There were 8 states. Now I just have to prove that my picture is true. Okay, but the other thing I could try to do is try to analyze why this will never get to 0, 0. How do I get to the idea that we'll never get to 0, 0? Let's see if we can do a couple of different proof sketches for this. We're not going to go into the full detail, but we're going to just try a couple of approaches we could do. Let's start by contradiction. Okay, so let's assume that the kth state reached is this 0,0 state for some k greater than 0. Right? Assume we got to 0,0. And then we can try to argue about the previous state. So we can say, then the k minus 1th state was, okay, we got one state. How could we have gotten to this state? Well, we're taking something mod 3. So we know it had a 0 over here because we had a 0 here, right? And those map across. That's how our function did it. It moves that second number to the first. And this number here had to be something that when added to that yields 0. So this had to be something where x mod 3 equals 0. It had to be a multiple of 3. Okay, so I now know that my previous state was a multiple of 3. And then I can also say the k minus second state was also some number. Okay, the state before this one had the x over there, it had a y over there. It needed to produce a 0. And so this had to have, we already know that x mod 3 is 0. We knew that y mod 3 is 0. And so we got here from multiples of 3. Now, we haven't finished our proof yet. What we want to just sort of do is say dot, 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 always multiples of 3. Dot, 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 of course, is not part of a proof. But the concept of dot, dot, dot is handled by induction. Right? We have sort of looked at this and said, okay, we have to have had multiples of 3 all the way down. To get to 0, we had to have the sum of two multiples of 3, which meant had to have the sum of two multiples of 3. We could keep going, show those have to be the multiple sum of multiples of two numbers, sets of values of 3 as well. And so we could try doing induction that says to ever get to two multiples of 3, we have to start with two multiples of 3. And so we could do a proof by contradiction with a proof by induction inside. Okay. We could also try arguing. So that's one avenue we could go. We could also state, okay, we knew that x and y were both multiples of 3 in order to get a 0 there, because the sum of two multiples of 3 had to be a multiple of 3. But if that was the case, then x had to come from the sum of two multiples of 3, which means that x had to be 0. Because x had to be result of something mod 3. Eventually, everything had to have come from something mod 3. And so the only thing mod 3 that's equal to 0 is 0. And so we could also show that if state k is 0,0, then state k minus 1 is 0,0. And then we could do induction to show that we had to start at 0,0 to get to 0,0. Again, there's going to be some mix of induction going on here. We could also have started with induction and tried to show that we would never, that given that we didn't start with multiples of 0, we'll never reach them. So these proofs can get a little messy. They often have some induction and some contradiction in them. They often have some not obvious property of the function in question, of the states that are reachable, that are part of what we're going through. We'll try looking at a few examples of these on Wednesday and also a few other places these will show up. But we are out of time for today. So I will talk to you all on Wednesday.